Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The temptation to traffic in eagle parts reveals an underbelly of greed that stretches beyond South Dakota. SDPB's Kevin Wooster has been covering the illegal eagle trade since the 1980s. Some things, it seems, never change. You can find Kevin Wooster's blog, on the other hand, on our website, sdpb.org/Wooster. You can find Kevin Wooster on In the Moment every Thursday. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, and boy, that isn't it amazing that that just goes on and on, and I assume it'll continue to go on and on, as John Cooper said in there, that as long as there's a market, somebody seems to be willing to do stuff to fill it, and there seems to be a market. So,
yeah, let's start there with sort of your personal experience of covering this, which I think a lot of people maybe only have a vague awareness. How pervasive is it in South Dakota over the years?
Well, it's one of the first things. When I started working for the Argus Leader in the late 1970s, I met John Cooper, and he was a pretty young, we're both not pretty young anymore, federal warden operating out of Pierre, and he was working on a number of these cases and came up with a major sting operation, undercover operation back then, that I reported on, and they're complicated too, because sometimes you have Native Americans that are involved in this trade, and Native Americans obviously have traditional and spiritual needs for eagle feathers and eagle parts. And that first case that was there was actually one case that I write about in the blog, where a Native man from the Yankton tribe took it to the Supreme Court, argued that there was a tree right there to kill eagles for spiritual purposes. And that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Justice Department and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in that case, that there is other, and essentially what it means is that eagle parts must go through a process, and that they are then given to bona fide members of recognized tribes for spiritual purposes. And usually that's not what these things are about. They're almost always about commerce, and that's what it was back then, and that's what this most recent case was.
Tell me about the most recent case, please.
Well, and, this is a big thing. That first one that I covered so many years ago was about a 19-month case, and this was about that same length, where they bring undercover people in and end up working their way into this, what U.S. Attorney Seiler called the underbelly, and have this black market for these parts. And this time it was a little bit more focused than the one that I recall, and a couple cents on the market and the places they were selling, including some pawn shops and some, and then there's this online component too, where you can actually buy parts, or sometimes you can find places where you can try to buy those parts or the regalia that they make from them online, and go all over the world, all over the United States and all over the world. So there are 31 people in two indictment sequences in April, and then this last one of 15 and then 16. And obviously, innocent until proven guilty, so we don't want to go too far on a lot of these, but thing that seems to continue, and the sad thing.
You mentioned, sometimes there's Native Americans involved in this, which complicates the conversation because of treaty rights, but sometimes there isn't. Who else is trafficking in these parts? Who's buying, who's buying eagle feathers, and for what reason, if it's not for a spiritual, reason? Where's, follow the money a little bit and tell me who's making money off these?
Well, as John Cooper said, some people just like to put them on their wall at home and their wall in their office. Some people like to have them. The first case that I recall, there was a Native American artist that was involved in this, a craftsman that was making beautiful, beautiful things, traditional, lovely creations, but most of the feathers involved were illegal. Mm-hmm. And it isn't always a case where the people that are doing this might necessarily know that the parts that they have are illegal, once they kind of get laundered. But a lot of people do know, and a lot of them are non-Native people that are interested in the sales and the trade, and others that are just careless, perhaps, in the way they buy things and don't really care whether they were acquired or legally or illegally. Hmm. And that, too, has been part of it. And I think that's what this operation was really trying to do, is to get at the buyers, to get at the market for it, and try and do something about that.
How significant is South Dakota in this sort of national or international trade, you know, compared to other states? Do you know?
Well, part of the thing about this was it's hard to tell where all these eagles came from. And there were other birds involved, too, hawks. There were both golden eagles and bald eagles and also hawks and owls. But certainly some of them came from here. Some of them were killed here. Some were killed elsewhere. There is, in those early years where I was covering a lot of this stuff with John Cooper, I actually went to places where he would confiscate eagles, you know, because they get eagles in a lot of ways. They would get electrocuted back then, sitting on highline wires that have now been changed so that they're safer for eagles and you get less of that. People would shoot them. There were some people out in goose country that didn't like eagles hanging around concentrations of geese that would shoot them. Because they wanted to hunt those geese. They didn't want the birds in there killing them, moving them around and things. And other ways they died, poisoning. There were a number of eagles died from lead poisoning back when there was still a lot of lead shot being used, and the geese on the river would eat the lead shot, die of lead poisoning. The eagles would eat the geese, get the lead pellets out of their gizzards or in their blood system, and they would get lead poisoning. And all those birds end up at the Eagle Repository, which was once in Pocatello, Idaho, and is now near Denver. And so the illegal taken birds that are confiscated and the ones that are found or the ones that there was no known cause of death or had a other cause of death are all together so that Native people can have them. And, you know, we've got a fair number of golden eagles in the state. We've got bald eagles in the state. And we had an eagle refuge that unfortunately was part of that first case way back when down by, you know, the Carl Munt Refuge, that back when eagles were still considered to be endangered, and on the list, there were seven, sometimes hundreds of them gathered there in the winter, and so that was a real vulnerable area for the birds to be taken.
What do these indictments, you know, what kind of message do they send for the future for folks in South Dakota and beyond?
Well, it's big money, you know. Some, mm-hmm. if it's a felony, you're up to $250,000 and possible fine and time in prison, and plus they will tag on. Penalties, per bird penalties, civil penalties, that if a judge allows that and they can prove it, you know, $10,000 plus, depending on how many parts or birds are involved. So it's certainly a message that this is a bad deal and you'd be wise not to do it for a number of reasons, not the least of which is your own well-being.
All right, let's change topics. And if you're just tuning in, my guest Kevin Wooster is here every week at this time. You can hear Kevin, but you can find his blog 24/7 on our website, sdpb.org/Wooster. And not up on the blog yet, but you're working on it now, is something about the 10-year anniversary of the injury that paralyzed Billy Sutton, South Dakota State Senator.
Yeah, in fact, it just went up. I try to not promise something I may not deliver because sometimes I get caught or everything. But they contacted me, and I imagine they contacted some others about yesterday being the 10-year anniversary that Billy Sutton, you know, the Democratic state senator from Burke and a gubernatorial candidate, and a rodeo rider of great promise, you know, who did really well in college rodeo and high school rodeo and was just on the professional circuit, you know, in his early 20s. Minot rodeo October 4th, 10 years ago, and the horse reared up and the chute came over on him, and there was a broken chute somehow that he landed on with the horse, and that all of that converged in this just really unfortunate way to have a spinal injury that left him at that time paralyzed from the belly button down. And this was him looking back on it, because every October 4th, obviously, that's a moment when he looks back on the way his life changed. And this blog is about how he's come to terms with that and how he's, you know, recovered from that and how he's gone on to look back in that with certain regrets, but not, you know, with thinking that's the way his life was supposed to go.
Yeah. How it changed everything in his life in some ways, right?
Obviously, because not only did it end his rodeo career, but his folks had plans for him to, after his rodeo days were over, to come back and take over their ranch in the beautiful Missouri River Breaks by Burke. And you know, given that impairment, it would be pretty hard for him to do all the things that you have to do to be the ranch manager. And you know, he's a smart guy, and he now works in a bank in finance and investments, and he turned to public service, and he's, as a Democrat, he's won won four Senate terms down there, the last two without opposition in a district that there is room for Democrats to win down in that region, and they have won, but it still has a, I think he told me, a 1,500 vote advantage in the legislative district for Republicans. So he can get Republican votes, has proven that. And as he told me, when he looks at what he does and what the things he gets out of his public service, and the, you know, he's got a family, he's got a wife, he's got a 16-year-old son or a 16-month-old son, and he looks at that and says, all of this is better than any belt buckle I could have won at the National Final Rodeo. You know?
What you mentioned a little bit in the blog about, you know, hope for the future. Is he hoping that he could regain any kind of mobility? Are there scientific areas that have promised to help Billy Sutton and others with a similar injury?
Yeah, you know, they're doing so much with work on nerve regeneration and cell research, you know, stem cells and things. And as he said, at the time it happened, when he tried to kind of gather himself, he said, this isn't the worst time in the world to get this injury. It's a time of many developments and much hope. And you know, there is some there for him to work with, because he has now developed movement in his hips. And that, boy, that makes a huge difference, you know, because that allows him to sit on a special saddle and get out on the horse, obviously, to be careful in how much he can do. But he can go out and rope, and he can work around and ride with his family and do those things. And the horse riding itself apparently is a muscle memory thing. The motion of the horse is like walking in many ways, and it helps him not only keep his muscles strong, but as this you know, deep down in the cells of who we are, this recollection of movement, which is apparently more important than we can imagine. And he's got even a little bit of movement in his legs, and all of that allows him to really keep his core strong, and he does a lot of that work. And so he hopes, with the scientific developments and his continuing work on these kinds of things, muscle memory and the development that they have, that he'll walk again someday.
Kevin Wooster's blog, sdpb.org/Wooster. Kevin, thank you so much for being here today. We'll see you next week.
Yeah, we'll see you for sure.